Our next case is case number 9SC668, Jackson versus Unicall Corporation. Let's see, we're ready. Is the other side ready? Thank you. Just a quick reminder, please state your name and who you represent, and you gotta keep track of your time. Please proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Kevin Hannon, I'm here on behalf of plaintiffs. I want to thank you for the opportunity to address you today. I want to briefly outline the points I hope to cover here. First of all, to show Rule 23 itself, how this shows how the Court of Appeals erred in requiring a predominance of evidence standard, the resolution of expert credibility and testimony, and so invading this trial court's discretion. I want to show how the language of Rule 23 shows that it's a non-merits determination contrary to what the Court of Appeals ruled here. That there are safeguards in Rule 23, and that's in part the reason why we don't need to turn Rule 23 into case screening, a merits determination, and that there are other safeguards in the process for the reason why Rule 23 simply isn't case screening and a case merits determination. I want to refer quickly to the principles of class certification in Colorado as they impact these issues. I want to show the practical impacts of the Court of Appeals decision here. I want to address specifically how it erred in requiring the resolution of expert credibility, and then I'd like to address what we believe your decision here today should say. So let me start from that beginning. Rule 23, the purpose clearly is case management. It's an early as practicable determination. Two reasons. Number one, that case management determination is going to guide discovery in the general course of the case. So it's a decision that occurs before, early in the case, before any merits determination and any work on developing the merits. But there's another reason why this is an early as practicable decision, and that's because of notice to the class. Because Rule 23 is designed not only to determine these common issues and whether or not the trial court can use this efficient management tool for common claims, but also to protect the rights of class members who may not be named representatives.
Mr. Hannon, I would really love to hear your thoughts. I mean, you can find hundreds of class action cases that say something words like this, sort of the determination of the class can overlap to some degree with the merits, or words to that effect, without really defining the quantum of standard. It's almost like I've said it, you know, I know it when I see it. So how do we think about that, and what does that mean, and what are the merits effect, for instance, in the Court of Appeals, if any, okay, in the Court of Appeals decision requiring preponderance?
Okay. Well, this case is a perfect example of that. The reason being, first of all, the issue that the trial court found, or the Court of Appeals found that the trial court erred on, was the resolution of merits. And so, for example, the court said that the trial court abused its discretion by declining to resolve which side's experts were more persuasive as to opinions potentially determinative of class certification. And there they were referring to whether or not the contiguous properties were contaminated. At the same time, the court requires on remand that the trial court weigh the conflicting testimony concerning alleged direct contamination of the contiguous properties. So this, as the court set out this predominant standard, it required proof of injury of fact, which is not required in the law, and it required, therefore, a merits determination. But that was not the issue here. The issue was whether there were common questions of fact or law. And here, Your Honor, there was no dispute as to whether there was a common methodology for determining whether the contiguous properties were contaminated. There was no dispute that there was a common methodology for determining whether the class had a common loss in value. And there was no dispute that the remediation damages could be determined from a common methodology. So that's why this case shows the impact of the predominant standard.
Well, wait a minute. Should the standard be what the trial judge said in this case, that merits are inappropriate, but just whether or not the plaintiff's evidence is admissible? That's what I think he's... that I'm reading from the opinion. That's what was said. Well, was that the right way to look at this?
Well, I think it is the right way to look at this for a couple reasons. Okay, number one, where class certification comes in the process. This is not summary judgment. And if we look at summary judgment, for example, in the summary judgment standard, trial court can't resolve the credibility of expert testimony, can't resolve the merits, weigh the merits of any evidence. So this is an earlier case management determination, and the court can't make a finding on pure admissibility as a requirement for class certification, because this is an early case management decision. There's
Mr. Hanna, I'm trying to get a standard. Right. But confusing to me. I mean, suppose you didn't have an expert at all. You had a bunch of guys off the street that said, you know, we all know asbestos in the air. And they had five experts that they submitted. Now, I think that I'm an engineering student, and I can barely qualify as, you know, I might eke by under some Shrek analysis as an expert. Is that good enough to get you class certification? Maybe it's admissible here.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Because if you
isn't that proving too much?
Isn't it proving, requiring too much?
No, requiring too little.
No, it's not requiring too little, Your Honor. If you don't require that standard in summary judgment, how can you require it here in the class management determination? We don't apply preponderance of evidence to whether or not a modified case management order is required, and in essence, this is a case management order. So what the trial court did here, there was one issue which the Court of Appeals found there was this evidentiary battle, and it was on the issue, and the only place the trial court applied the sum evidence standard, which I think you're alluding to, is on the issue of whether or not the class was identifiable. And following Cook and Boggs and numerous other cases through history, and unique to these environmental cases, what the trial court found, and all these cases require, is some evidence of a reasonable relationship between the way the class is defined and how that evidence, that contamination evidence, is going to be presented at trial. So we know just that there's and the class boundaries don't go on forever. So certainly, and the court here took one more step, and it relied on language from the In Re Visa Check case. And that should be the standard here. And that is that the expert's testimony was not so flawed as to be inadmissible. That's a standard, first of all, that's been adopted by the Vermont Supreme Court addressing similar issues here. Number two, it's the standard that defendant proposed to the trial court and also proposed to the Court of Appeals. And it's also consistent with the purposes, the principles of our class action law. Our principles of our class action law, as this court stated in Benzing, is that Rule 23 should be liberally construed in light of its policy favoring the maintenance of class actions. So if we create a standard of pure admissibility here, what's going to happen to this class certification process? It's going to turn out to be a quagmire of an expert battle on the merits. It's going to be a trial on the merits. If you're trying to judge whether or not this methodology proves the ultimate fact, And so here, the standard should be that low threshold standard. It requires some showing by the plaintiffs. In other words, you couldn't just walk in with me off the street and say, here it is. So it requires some showing. And what happened here was the district court looked at, and we go back into context, this is one of the safeguards. The plaintiff's experts presented their opinions by affidavit, and the plaintiff's expert, Mr. Spear, was deposed. So defendant had the opportunity to evaluate the plaintiff's expert testimony and through the class certification hearing process present all the evidence it wanted in to rebut the issue in this hearing, whether there are common questions of law or fact. The focus is on the common questions, not what the answers are. And that makes sense from the standpoint of this is an early case management decision. And there are safeguards here. Let's assume, Your Honor, that maybe you would suggest later on proof shows that the methodology wouldn't work because all you're trying to do is require this early low standard. Well, there are safeguards in this rule. The first, of course, is that the decision can be amended or altered at any time, and the decision can be conditional. It's fundamental to Rule 23. So that safeguard exists. As the facts develop and as the merits of the case are presented, then the court has that safeguard, of course, that it can change or alter its decision based on new information. And it gives the right to the defendants to challenge that certification as it goes on. Of course, there is the process of summary judgment and that certain issues may be resolved that may change the look of the class. But the important point in summary judgment, again, is even in summary judgment, after discovery, usually after expert reports are prepared, the court doesn't allow, require a trial court to make a determination of the credibility of evidence. In fact, there, I'm just paraphrasing, but it's the court can only not rely on evidence in creating a genuine issue of material fact if it's so incredible that a reasonable juror couldn't believe it. A very similar standard. Now, that comes here. After the case is developed here, when the court is making a simple case management determination in its discretion, after it's heard the evidence, what is the best way to make an early management decision? And it decides certification. And of course, later on, there are other safeguards for the defendants to show why this is not a merits determination. There can be that Shrek hearing. But if you require at class certification this to be a Shrek hearing, and it's part of the impact of the Court of Appeals decision here, this case, number one, you're going to delay the decision because we're going to have a challenge on whether or not that expert's even credible under the Shrek analysis. We're going to then have a challenge to the methodology, whether it's acceptable or not. Now we're going to have to require more extensive discussion and more in-depth expert reports on the merits. And then class certification is going to become a trial on the merits. So basically, and defendants and amici ask you to do this, to take what happens here at the end of the case and front load it before class certification. So it's going to take the cost and the burden of proving a trial in merits and put it into class certification, where it never should be, because this is just an early as practicable decision, which may be altered or amended at any time. Number two, what's going to happen there is it's going to preclude the very kind of cases that class actions are about. Those cases where there's minimal amounts at issue and the expense of litigation will overwhelm those minimal amounts. And the reason for that is, as counsel, I'm going to have to say to my client, now, the law's changed. At class certification, we're going to have to prove the merits. For example, in this case, we're going to have to prove the merits that every single contiguous property, the property has been, we're going to have to do that at class certification. We're going to have to incur all that expense. But we don't know if the case can go forward as class. The form of the case hasn't even decided yet. We don't know if that evidence will ever be used at trial, because we don't know the form of the case.
Mr. Hannon, what about the first, just the first question, preponderance of the evidence? Why is that wrong? I understand the expert's argument that you're making. What about the preponderance of the evidence? What does it mean?
Well,
to have
what it means, as the court implied, because this is a new standard, is that it's proof of injury in fact, proof of the merits of the case.
Because some proof of the merits of the case. Right.
Sorry?
Some proof.
Well, in this case, the Court of Appeals requires proof on ultimate issues. And not some proof. What it says, again, is that the trial court on remand has to weigh the conflicting testimony concerning alleged direct contamination of the contiguous properties. There's another instance. I can give you an example. I just want to use the.
I think you're right about. I understand that. But say, like in the case you just heard, the judge found that by preponderance of the evidence and certified the class. So what does that really mean in terms of the merits? That's my question.
Well, and that's.
And why is it wrong, in your opinion?
Your Honor, first of all, I think in the previous cases that you referred today, Jackson was referred to but never tested. There's not a case before you yet where there's a situation where the courts really apply Jackson and says this is what preponderance means. When we take, as an example, another of the Court of Appeals decision here, the Court of Appeals requires, by specific findings by a preponderance of the evidence, weighing plaintiff's proof that mere proximity of the contiguous properties to contamination results in unreasonable and substantial interference with the use and enjoyment of the contiguous properties. The court required that. That was the alternative theory. If we didn't prove that the contiguous properties were contaminated, injury in fact, then it was going to require us to prove that. What's wrong with that is that's the merits determination. That is one of the fundamental issues in the case, and it takes the merits determination from the jury and gives it to the trial court. And it's the impacts that come. Trying that merits decision and class certification when the trial court should be making a preliminary decision on how this case should be managed, front-loading all these costs, putting the plaintiffs in a position of bearing the cost of proving the merits before form of the action is even going to take place. And if class is not certified, then that those individual plaintiffs have suffered the entire expense of proving the merits on claims that don't justify individual action because of their modest nature.
Counsel, if I may interrupt you, I understand your concerns with the preponderance of the evidence standard, but I'm struggling to understand what alternative you offer. What should the standard be, and how would you articulate that?
Okay. So, Your Honor, the first thing is that we have existing standards. For decades now, we've had the Rule 23 requirements, and we've had the standards in the Court of Appeals that you judge compliance with Rule 23 based on whether trial court abused its discretion. And there's been no place in previous law that where it's screamed out that, boy, we need some other standard to evaluate that.
So it's simply this decision rests within the discretion of the trial court and it's reviewed for abuse of discretion, but there's no other identified quantum of proof that you would articulate.
The next thing I would say, Your Honor, is throughout the cases, plaintiffs clearly have the burden, which I would argue is a burden of persuasion, that we've met Rule 23 requirements. So the issue comes, and this case presents, would there be any point where the court would have to judge the credibility of evidence or balance or weigh this evidence? Here, the case didn't present that. The case doesn't present that issue because there was agreement that there were common methodologies to prove both the trespass and the damages that arise from the trespass. So this case doesn't present the need for a new standard. The standard I would articulate, and it's been articulated and used by the Court of Appeals, is if there was an issue, and let me back up. In most cases, it is rare, we don't have a case in front of us where there is the penultimate issue, where but for this one issue, the court, trial court, cannot decide whether there's a preponderance of questions of fact or law. We don't have that fact pattern before us, and we don't have any case that presents that fact pattern. So it's tough to create a standard in the absence of that. Because for predominance, it's multiple questions of fact, multiple questions of law that the court's looking at, not a single instance that's determined.
I'm interested in following that up because it does say, the rule says that the trial court has to make findings. So what's the threshold for making a finding?
The threshold for making a finding is whether or not the evidence presented, the information presented by the plaintiffs, satisfies the requirements of the rule. Simply that's it. And I'll just take it one step further in this rare instance. So, for example, with superiority, predominance of or preponderance of the evidence does nothing to tell us anything else about how to judge superiority. Because superiority is the discretion of the trial court based on all the evidence that it's heard. So preponderance is useless there.
How about the quality of the evidence? I mean, what? Substantial, competent?
Again, and going to Judge Marquez's question, first, the court should look, and this is what we would propose in your ruling to be here. First, the court should look to see whether it can come to rest on the class certification decision in ways other than resolving, balancing evidence, determining evidence, because there may be other predominating issues, for example, here, liability. But if there's a question of the quality of evidence, and it only goes to not which party's evidence is right, but whether or not I was just the guy off the street, then the standard should be the standard that is not so flawed to be inadmissible, or not so flawed that a reasonable jury couldn't accept that evidence. But that, again, those facts don't present themselves in this case, because we never reached the point where the issue with regard to a common question of fact or law, the issue of common methodology, was determined by whether or not evidence met some quantum or burden of proof. That's simply not in the case. I'd like to reserve the remaining time, if I may.
Steve Mishaki, Steve Mishaki representing NeoCal. This case presents two questions of first impression that are interrelated. The first being, should courts resolve expert disputes that are potentially dispositive of class certification issues? So, not expert disputes on the merits, but expert disputes that are potentially dispositive of class certification elements. And secondly, what standard applies? Now, these two really work together, and accordingly, when I discuss them, I'd like to start by addressing the expert issues and sort of segue into the preponderance, because I think it'll help you see how these fit together. Here, the plaintiffs are seeking damages for injury to property. Now, there are, contrary to what you just heard, important expert disputes that go to the class certification issues. One is there asbestos present on the contiguous properties? Now, this may overlap with a merits issue, but it is critical to two class certification issues, one of which is the class definition, which is part of the numerosity inquiry, and secondly, is there a common method of proving injury that is class-wide? The same is true with respect to the evidence from the appraisers with respect to whether there is stigma injury here. Is there any stigma, and is there a class-wide method of proving it? Resolving these disputes by a preponderance is critical here, and it will not prejudge the merits. Resolving them will not resolve liability. It won't resolve who will prevail on any particular affirmative defense. It won't resolve quantity of damages. And it won't even resolve causation. Technically, it won't resolve how that asbestos got on there, whether it's from this pipeline, some other pipeline, some farming activities that occurred with an old tractor that had asbestos in its brakes. But the question is there any asbestos on these properties?
Can I stop you there? Why is that the question at this stage? Why are we more concerned with do the plaintiffs, are they advancing a theory by which they would prove the presence of asbestos in a common way? That one theory, is it a common theory?
That is one of the issues that this relates to. Mm-hmm. But in addition, in order for the court to determine how numerous this class is, the court has to define it.
Let me stop you there a second. There is always this kind of problem about, and we've run into it with a number of cases today, about numerosity, but why isn't that a question of the class alleged by the plaintiffs, asserted by them, and whether they can prove all of the elements for certification for that class? Obviously, if they may want to set the class broadly for purposes of numerosity, but if they do that, they're going to maybe have trouble establishing that all of those class members have a common, have common facts or law, or that they are really representative of that entire class. So you got this play back and forth about deciding whether all of these elements would be met for purposes of certifying a class, but in terms of defining the class, or alleging the class, why isn't that a matter for the plaintiffs to do and then see if they can meet the requirements of the rule with regard to that class?
Because they have to, it's their burden to prove up that we're going to use a class action process rather than some individual process. They have to prove to the court that, in fact, these putative class members are different than the rest of the world in some way. Now, there's going to be scenarios, Justice Coates, where it's not going to be as big a deal. I think that an example might be you've got a wage claim case of some kind, a wage act case, where you know who the employees are, you know they're in a certain category of employee, you know this common policy has been applied to them. You don't have to guess whether they've been sort of subjected to the policy. In a case like this, we are here today not knowing, having no proof that even one fiber of asbestos is on these contiguous properties, and yet, according to the trial court at least, we had a certified contiguous property class with trespass claims and negligence claims. So it's critical there. And it also is important with respect to the other issue you identified, which is there class-wide proof? How are you going to go about proving it in that way? In Benzing, this court said that, in fact, the most relevant issue to the predominance inquiry is whether the plaintiff has a method to establish on a class-wide basis that the defendants caused injury to the proposed class. So it's absolutely critical to deal with this now and rather than later.
But in that very language in Benzing, we didn't seem to be saying, did we, can you prove that there was injury, but rather, is there a common theory or a common approach to proving the injury?
That's correct. And we submit that this evidence goes to both issues, both the definition and to the common method. Let me see if I can kind of step back and describe how this came about. This asbestos on this property is, on the easement properties, as you know, there's an easement class and there is a contiguous class. So on the easement properties, this asbestos is visible. It's in visible chunks. No one has ever seen one of these chunks on a contiguous property. The plaintiff's expert, Mr. Spear, hasn't, and our abatement team has not. And with respect to invisible asbestos, there is no air sampling that has ever detected one fiber of asbestos on these properties. So now we're getting into your supposedly common method of proof, which is Dr. Gunnison's air diffusion model. Spear admitted that this was the only evidence he had seen of contamination on these contiguous properties. Now, again, this was theoretical and a model. It wasn't sampling. And they only provided, the plaintiffs here didn't even provide the model. They provided a short one-paragraph summary of it and then several pages of handwritten calculations. So that is their proof of contamination here. Now, our experts said there's no science behind this. The model, first of all, didn't even attempt to prove current contamination of those properties. It attempted to prove contamination within 12 hours after the pipeline was dug out of the ground back in 1996 to 1998. So that's all it was even intended to prove. Our experts said there are no basis for the assumptions that were used underlying it, and there's no basis for the methodology. With respect to the assumptions, these included that the pipeline was uniformly 10 inches. In fact, most of it, very little of it was 10 inches. The vast majority was between 4 and 8. That the top half of it was stripped off and left there on the property. Well, we know that the vast, vast majority of this asbestos was stripped off at a distant site where Unocal had a facility. The experts said that 20% of this wrap was friable, meaning you can crumble it up, and that half of that actually was dispersed within 12 hours. Well, our experts said that was nonsense. You pull this stuff out of the ground, and the way this pipe was built is there's a pipe, you put tar on it, and you put this asbestos felt on it, and usually there was a cover over top of that. So as our expert put it, this was entrained in tar, and it could not have been friable and crumbled and blown away. And so that these assumptions were just nonsense. He said the same thing about the methodology. He said that the plaintiff's expert, he wasn't even designated expert, actually, that Dr. Gunnison took this sample, crumbled it up, baked it at 500 degrees centigrade, and then assumed that that's what blew away. He said, again, that is total nonsense. This stuff was entrained in tar. It wouldn't have been like asbestos that is crumbled and baked at 500 degrees centigrade. So that was a critical dispute as to whether they had any proof of any injury whatsoever, much less proof that was common to the entire class. So it related to both issues, and it was absolutely critical for the trial court to resolve that important dispute. Incidentally, in the reply brief, there was a statement that our experts somehow agreed that it was difficult, if not meaningless, to do air modeling, or actually air sampling. And we said, and in fact, our expert helped design a study in Nebraska. This was presented during the class hearing. This pipeline that is in question actually goes up into Nebraska. And Cherokee, the same contractor, took the pipeline out there. And so a study was done there where actual air sampling was taken. And 42 out of 43 samples came back negative for asbestos in that study. And the 43rd had a single fiber. Now, this was on the easement itself, not perhaps 2 to 3 miles away on a contiguous property. Again, this is not, this has an overlap with a merits issue. It is not resolving the merits of claims. And in fact, if we don't deal with this now, to severely prejudice a defendant because you think these issues are not necessarily going to come up again at the merits case.
Why not?
Well, in this case, Your Honor...
I mean, it sounds like you got great defense, the way you talk about it.
Well, we weren't... I think we do, but we were not permitted by the trial court to take depositions or to force contiguous property members, for example, to allow us to set up air sampling on their properties. If we weren't allowed to do it then, surely we're not going to be allowed to do it at the merits phase. And so if that's, you know, it is simply not... going to be something that necessarily comes up. We're not going to be allowed to go property by property and go in and put air monitors on all these contiguous properties.
I don't want to throw you off too much here, but it's after listening to that discussion, and then you finished it up by saying, but this is not a determination on the merits. But I guess to my ear, it's hard for me to distinguish that. It seems to me it is a determination on the merits, and not to do this in too exaggerated a way, but it seems to me kind of like what you're saying is, well, if I decide that you have you've presented a common approach or common theory that will apply to your whole group, but I'm going to decide that if that's your method of proof, you'll surely lose. So I'm just going to rule against you right now. That is, you don't seem to be, I'm wondering, you say this is something the trial court has to resolve. This is a factual dispute. I can see that there are very many things that go directly to the requirements of Rule 23 that the court would have to resolve. You know, if however the class is set by the plaintiffs, if there's a dispute about whether, a factual dispute about whether that would include 20 people or 2,000 people, the trial judge would presumably have to resolve that to decide the numerosity question. But why is the determination whether your method of proof is likely to work something that goes to the question of class certification?
Well, I think it's more than that. Your method of proof really doesn't work here. And it seems to me that if you're going to use this device that is going to sweep in all of these people where we have no idea whether they have actual contamination, you are not adequately meeting your burden to say these people are proper members of the class. That's the whole purpose of a class action in the first place. So, you know, furthermore, Your Honor, we need to prove, excuse me, I'm trying to sort of backtrack and come at your question.
See, I've managed to confuse this issue.
I have a question. Oh, go ahead, please. Are there parts of Rule 23 that are less amenable to a preponderance of the evidence standard? For example, the superiority component that opposing counsel mentioned? Or is it your contention that preponderance of the evidence standard ought to apply to every aspect of proving up the rules requirements?
It's the latter, and it's not just numerosity. And I think the way, as a practical matter, this would work out, so folks are a little loose sometimes, and they're talking about how this, practically speaking, will work out. Some of them say you have to find facts underlying the various elements of Rule 23A and B, and some say you have to find all these elements by a preponderance. And I think that really the best roadmap for you is the In Re IPO decision. And in that case, what the court says is essentially class action requirements are factual inquiries. And so you have to find facts underlying each of the elements. For example, with respect to numerosity, you need to determine who's a member of the class, and you need to determine how many of them are there. And then, once you do that, numerosity is essentially a legal standard. So the court says, well, this is kind of a mixed question of fact and law. And so you're going to apply that standard to those facts that you found. But it's absolutely critical that you find those facts by preponderance. I don't know what other standard is being proposed here. It's just an amorphous whether the trial court has discretion. But there are going to be fact findings that have to be made here, and those findings need to be made by preponderance.
Let me ask a couple of follow-up questions then. So assuming that the class is certified by preponderance of the evidence, and given the statements in Benzing that the court has a continuing obligation to make sure that class is the appropriate vehicle for this particular litigation, defense comes back with additional information. Is plaintiff put in the same position again of having to reprove those aspects of Rule 23 again by a preponderance of the evidence, or how do you see that playing out?
Well, the plaintiff, I think, under Benzing, always maintains the burden of establishing that a class action is proper. So you never shift the burden over to the defendant to disprove all the elements of the class, the requirements of a class action. But we would need, we being UNICA, would need to come in and show some kind of new evidence or new legal standard in order to have a basis to move to decertify. If we did, then yes, the plaintiff would have to have that burden, as they always do. Does that answer your question?
Yes. And then how does that play out on review, where the standard is abuse of discretion?
Well, I think the way that it plays out is like this. The court makes its findings. It makes its fact findings with respect to, we gave an example of numerosity, with respect to adequacy of representation, what in fact experience does the plaintiff's counsel have, and all these other things, and makes findings in that regard. I think abuse of discretion comes in a couple of ways. Number one, did the court actually evaluate all the evidence and make the findings that it needed to make? Number two, did the court err in some way in applying those legal standards? So in other words, you're applying a legal standard like predominance or numerosity or whatever to the facts that have been found. There's some discretion that is involved in that process, a weighing of evidence and a making of a determination. And so I think that that's where the discretion comes in a second time.
The trouble is, I think, and what's of concern is that the Court of Appeals seems to be maybe going farther in its remand directions, where it says at page 28 of the slip opinion that on remand, the trial court shall weigh the conflicting testimony and make specific findings under the preponderance of evidence standard concerning alleged direct contamination of the contiguous properties, but only to the extent necessary to decide whether an identical class of that property owners has been established. And that last clause is essentially meaningless, isn't it? I mean, what the court there seems to be saying is that they have to find out whether or not there was contamination of these properties, which would mean that they would have to resolve under a Schreck standard or something else this conflicting expert testimony.
Well, I think that what the court is saying there is you don't, and other courts have said this as well, you don't go into any merits issue that is not relevant to a class requirement. So here it just so happens, and
So what would the judge say? I'm sorry I interrupted you, but what would the judge say? He would say, I believe this expert and not that expert, and as a result of believing this expert, I find that the property was not contaminated. Therefore, I find that they cannot be a class. They cannot be members of the class, or the class cannot be defined to be contiguous property owners. Right? I mean, isn't that what you would be looking for?
I think that is right, that the court would say, you haven't identified people who are property owners of this class.
Uh-huh.
Whether it's contiguous property or people who are, maybe they have another expert who comes in and says, oh, I think this asbestos went 25 miles.
Sure.
And we'd have the same problem. And that's right. The court would reach that conclusion. But the court wouldn't reach the conclusion, for example, let's say the court said it did get there. Either way, the merits still have to be proven to a jury later on. So. In other words,
you're saying that whatever the court's finding was with respect to experts would not be, what do they call it, law of the case, that could be completely relitigated in the merits?
That's correct. It is not a decision that is binding on the fact finder with respect to the merits. And indeed, if the court determined that no class is appropriate, this case would go forward with these five plaintiffs or groups of plaintiffs, and they would attempt to prove up their case on the merits.
I didn't understand that to be the thrust of the federal the federal approach. I thought the federal approach was more putting some weight behind the whole word satisfied in the rule so that there was some evidentiary basis or weight given to that, and that it would become law of the case as opposed to just simply a class certification.
I'm not aware of any case that says that.
Well, I'm not sure that it says it. I guess that's just the way I understood it. What are you referring to say that it wouldn't be law of the case?
Well, in other words, courts have said that, for example, when this decision is not one that is binding on the jury. So a trial court at the class cert hearing is deciding the class cert elements, and that's all. If there happens to be an incidental overlap, which there does in this case, well, that is not binding on the fact finder. We aren't having any sort of collateral estoppel or res judicata effect with respect to any issue here. If there happens to be an overlap, well, you still decide the issue.
So you would perceive, the way you would play it out in your mind then is that at trial, both experts would testify again, and the jury would be asked to make the decision as to whether these people are appropriately members of class?
How
would that play itself out?
If the class were not certified, then these folks who are the named plaintiffs would go forward and they would present their case, and indeed they have just individually huge damage claims here, and they would attempt to convince a jury that in fact among all the other issues they have contamination. Now of course they'd also have to prove that this asbestos came from the pipeline we used to own, that we were responsible and not Cherokee, et cetera, their damages. But that's the way, you know, it would work out. Now if the class were certified, then we still would go back to this particular merits issue would be addressed again in the merits trial.
If that's the way the trial would play out, then what's the advantage of class certification?
Well,
because it sounds like you would be having a lot of little mini trials about this, the same issues that you're fighting about over class certification.
Well, I think there's two responses to that question. Number one is that quite often, and this is really part of the basis underlying Rule 23F, once a class is certified, it's really ball game over. Whoever loses, loses. And if you have, unlike this case, quite a number of small claims, then it's going to be difficult to justify pursuing those small claims. If you have a case where the liability is enormous for a defendant, and the liability is enormous for the defendant here, potentially, then again, there's tremendous pressure to settle. So that's one reason why it's important to get it right now. A second reason is this, is that the whole purpose of a class action device is they're presenting class-wide proof, and we're presenting a class-wide defense. It was just like it was being discussed in the last argument. There was a debate over, well, you know, can't you go out and get some of these other unnamed class members and try to prove out that their claims are really different or that their motivations were different? I think the short answer is no, typically. The whole idea of a class action is that these people represent the rest of the class. And so their claims are typical and their claims are common. And they go forward and they represent everyone else. And
Go ahead. But that's a little inconsistent with the wording of our rule, which is different than the federal rule. And it seems to me it cuts both ways, like in the last case. The judge found there that there was a class by a preponderance of the evidence. So it would be really, under what you're arguing, very difficult to ever reopen that, no matter what the facts were before the merits. That's inconsistent with what we've said generally about a class action being, as your opponent says, you know, a management tool, and it's conditional and so forth. All that.
Well, it is a management tool, but it's not a mere management tool, Your Honor. It is a very powerful device that is a very powerful thing for plaintiffs to put together and a very powerful thing for defendants to defend against. And again, that's part of the reason we have this appeal right now, Rule 23F, is that it is considered to be just a momentous decision. and it's something that you ought to be able to at least try to bring up right away on appeal. So, you know, I don't think it's inconsistent with what this court has said before, because of, you know, yes, we have this interpretation in the past that it's something that ought to be liberally construed, but we also have this recognition with 23F that it is a very momentous decision.
I still haven't heard a good argument why the burden of proof in a civil action, which is preponderance, translates over to this finding, this inquiry, this explanation, this reasoned explanation, this intensive look, whatever it is that the trial judge is doing to trigger this mechanism for handling the case.
Well, I think that, Your Honor, if you're going to find a fact and you have a dispute over something, there's really no other sensible way to do it. I guess you could do it as an even higher burden of proof, like clear and convincing. But if you have two competing sets of evidence, and the court is going to have to make findings that underlie these particular class requirements, it's virtually compelled that the court is going to have to use the preponderance standard. That is the standard that we use to make fact findings in all sorts of situations. The Court of Appeals gave a couple of examples in attorney fee situations and restitution in criminal matters. Another example I could give it would be disqualification motions. This court has said that in connection with, for example, whether similar acts evidence comes in, a court finds acts by a preponderance, that's the underlying fact finding, but then it still has discretion when it comes in and it weighs that evidence and weighs those facts and makes a decision as to whether the evidence comes in.
You think that the trial judge in this instance needs to do a full-blown Shrek hearing? The Court of Appeals seemed to be a little quiet about that.
I haven't thought specifically about that issue. We certainly did challenge both the methodology and the reliability.
You're basically saying that the opposing expert is using junk science.
I think that's right. I think the short answer is yes, that this judge has got to decide whether this evidence is any good at all. And our position is it's not. I want to try to get back to the question, and I'm not clear anymore about what it was, but I wanted to make sure that I got back to your question, Justice Coates. I think part of it was, why is it critical to resolve this now?
I suppose the question ultimately that I was trying to get at is what goes to damages. I mean, you seem to be saying it's important even just to know who can be in the class,
right,
that we decide whether this property is really contaminated.
Right. That's correct, just to be in the class. That's right.
Well, and that seems to then go toward, and I think, the direction that the Court of Appeals went of suggesting that you would have to prove damages. It would only be those people who could establish they were damaged that would even be part of the class.
I wouldn't say damages, Your Honor. We're not asking the court to find how much is on there, whether someone's...
Let's say injured.
Yeah, but I think that's right. I think that you do have to prove that there is injury. That's what defines the class. In this case, and again, there are going to be some cases. Most of the federal cases that we've cited, for example, and that the plaintiffs have cited, are securities fraud, antitrust, conspiracy cases. There are going to be many cases where it really just the basic fact of injury isn't going to be where the big fight is in a class certification decision. But when it is, then it's got to be decided. And in these contamination cases, it's an issue that has to be resolved now. I'm sorry, so my time is up. We ask the court to confirm the Court of Appeals.
Thank you. First, I'm going to address that last question. I think you were basically asking, is what you're requiring here a fail-safe class? fail-safe class is we're going to require, and if I came in and said to you, we'll define the class by all people who have contamination on their property.
Well, I'm sorry, you have so little time, let me interrupt you. It wouldn't make any sense, though, for a judge to have some expert come in and say, you know, I was using this divining rod, and I went out, and it can sense asbestos. And I walked all around, and every time it turned down, I know that that's a place that has asbestos. And the judge would say, okay, well, that's enough evidence, and I'm going to certify the class based upon that. I mean, you know, that's an absurd example, of course, but there has to be some common sense here. Somebody has to make a decision. The judge has to perform some kind of a gatekeeper's function.
Well, I don't think I would characterize it as a gatekeeper function, Your Honor, and that's exactly what the trial court did here. We presented evidence, and it was not just this model, but Mr. Spear, including some of his own research on the migration of asbestos, he presented multiple bases for his opinion of why.
Sure, and it very well may be true. So the issue is who decides and by what standard? Right. And this is a Shrek problem, isn't it?
It's not a Shrek
okay,
problem.
Okay, why not?
And the reason is, if you use the standard that we suggest is not so flawed to be inadmissible, which the court used here, which other courts have adopted in multiple circumstances, what that does is it provides a threshold to say you have to come up with you have to present evidence with some basis. That's what the court did here. The trial court made a determination, and it found that there was some reasonable evidence to support a nexus between the way the class was defined and what the likely evidence was going to be of contamination at trial. So that there was sufficient, without ever having a preponderance of evidence standard that didn't exist at the time, this trial court was able to examine the evidence and come to that conclusion. And Justice Brennan, to follow up on your comment, well, preponderance can be challenged later, because maybe at the Shrek hearing, at the end, not here, because that's going to turn into an expert quagmire, but maybe following, as the expert reports are prepared, and...
Can I follow up on that? So is what you're thinking is that there would be something less than a Shrek type of preponderance to determine the class, and then later on pretrial there might be a Shrek hearing which would kick out your expert, and wouldn't that vitiate the class?
It may, and that happens because defendants challenge class certification up to the day before trial and during trial based on the evidence, and the risk is always for any class member that some element of the class is going to be found against them. But that's the point. What we heard, to go back, later on, there may be something contrary to what plaintiffs present that says this methodology won't work. The question is, where does that challenge come? Is it going to come before we even know the general form of the action, before notice even goes out to people to decide whether they want to be part of the class or not? It should not, because it's a case management decision here. It's a case management tool. And what defense counsel started out with was the trial on the merits. We were getting into, well, was the sample baked the right way? And is that what class certification hearings are going to become? A full Shrek hearing? A full trial on the merits on whether or not this sample was picked up the right way or analyzed the right way? If we do that, we're never going to get to an earliest practicable determination on class certification. Justice Rice, you asked a question about the federal courts, and I wanted to follow up on that. Even in hydrogen peroxide, so this was a post-IPO case, relied on IPO. Even in hydrogen peroxide, the court said, plaintiff's burden at class certification stage is not to prove the element of antitrust impact. It said instead, the task for plaintiffs at class certification is to demonstrate that the element of antitrust impact is capable of proof at trial through evidence that is common to the class. And when defense counsel got up here, they talked about, he talked about an issue potentially dispositive of class certification. Well, the potentially dispositive issue for class certification is whether there's a common question, a question of a fact or a question of law. It's not whether or not that fact has been proved. And so the issue here, whether or not there was contamination on the contiguous properties, was not determinative of class certification. The question is what the parties proved, and that was that there were common methodologies. This is what defendants' experts said in a question from defense counsel. It's in the transcript, or it's in the, it's volume 4, 1160. The question, well, Dr. Kircher, please tell us what you saw as problems with the Gneisen air model. Answer, well, as I was saying, this is, it's a very simple model. There is nothing wrong with the math of the model per se, and I think it is appropriate for this particular situation. Volume 4, page 1160. That was the evidence. And that went to the heart of the issue that's before the court here. The issue is, what was dispositive of certification? It was not injury in fact. It's whether or not there were common questions. And there was...
You know, you have 10 seconds. I'll be fast. Here's the question. The common question came to who are people in the class? The class people have to have a common question,
and that's
I think what is frustrating me about this case.
No, that's exactly right.
Chief, can you respond to that? Would that be all right if he answered?
Certainly.
You can answer that.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That's the issue. The issue is not for class certification whether people have in fact been injured. And for example, there is no case, even given IPO and hydrogen peroxide in this environmental context, that requires proof of the presence of contamination to define a class. No case. So the issue here is not the proof of the issue, the injury, because that requires proof of injury in fact. It's the question that you identified. Is there a common methodology? And from the evidence that I just read, from the evidence that we cited in our brief with regard to the appraisal experts on loss and value, we demonstrated that there was a common methodology. And anything more, this preponderance standard in and of itself, as evidenced by how the Court of Appeals applied it, requires a determination of the merits contrary to benzene and requires proof of injury in fact. There's no other way to look at it, and that's why the Court of Appeals ruled the way it did.
Thank you. Ms. Masiaki, do you want to have any minute and a half for, I guess, sir, to answer Justice Rice's question? Sir, rebuttal? I don't know.
excuse me. Sort of giddy, I've never had this opportunity before.
I would figure you can add lab. Go ahead.
First of all, it simply isn't true that our experts agreed about this common method. With the appraisers, for example, our experts said, okay, it's theoretically possible to use these methods that the plaintiff's expert, Mr. Huntsberger, wants to use, but look at the inputs you would have to include. For example, was this property something that was sold between family members? And is that the reason that the price of the property was low? Were there waste sites, personal waste sites on these properties? And was that a reason that affected this sale price? And so accordingly, with respect to the appraisers, our experts said you would have to have subclasses with as little as one property in them. Talk about getting to the issue of individual issues predominating over common ones, contrary to 23B3. So there was a dispute as to whether there was a common way of proving this on a class-wide basis. With respect to the contamination issue, again, it is essentially an incidental overlap with the merits. It just happens that this dispute, in this case, happens to overlap with a merits issue. But that is no reason, as the courts have said, not to address the issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The court will stand in recess, and the case will be submitted on the briefs.